Students who are advocating against Israel can essentially do whatever they want on campus, completely free from repercussions. It is like textbook discrimination.
The flag was hoisted before the world.
What does it mean, fight back? We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here we are.
Here I am.
Here I am with Shai Davidai.
My guests today are Lishi Baker and Eden Yadiger. Did I get that?
Yes, you did.
All right. Student leaders at Columbia University. Lishi, you are the president of ARIA.
Co-president, yeah.
Co-president of ARIA with?
Eliana Golden and David Letterer.
All right, so we'll talk about ARIA. And Eden, you have been, I think a lot of people know you from, like, you've spoken in Congress, you've spoken in rallies and protests, but you were also the last year's president of SSI, Students Supporting Israel.
Yes, I was.
So we'll talk a lot about that. Thank you so much for joining me. I also have to acknowledge that it's weird. You're talking to like a professor in your university, but I think that the past year we've become more friends than anything else. I start this podcast like with everyone the same question. I'll start with you, Eden. Eden, what kind of a Jew are you?
I'm a very, very proud Jew. I'm a first-generation American. My parents were both born in Iran, but before anything else, I'm Jewish. And I'm very proud of the other parts of my identity, but how I really define myself is as a Jew. And as a Mizrahi Jew, we don't really do denominations. So I got to Columbia and everyone was like, oh, are you going to the conservative minion or the reform one? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm just going to Shabbat. Like, what do you mean? So I've definitely learned a lot about different types of Judaism in the last 3 years at Columbia. But before anything else, I'm proud to be Jewish, period.
So you've not only learned a lot, you probably, your presence there also taught other people a lot.
that's
because when people say, what do you mean? you're like, wait, Shabbat is Shabbat. And they're like, oh, Mizrahi Jews do it differently.
Exactly. Well, and I grew up in Los Angeles. So my Jewish community was like basically all Persian Jews. And then I got to Columbia and the majority of the Jewish students here are not Persian Jews. So it's been nice. It was a bit of an adjustment, I'm not going to lie. But it's been incredible to learn about the diversity within the Jewish community. That's not something I actually expected to get out of my college experience, despite the fact that I'm studying Jewish studies and spend like all my free time at the campus Hillel. So it's definitely been nice to, you know, obviously over the last year fight for the Jewish people, but also like, I'm not Jewish because of anti-Semites. I'm not Jewish because I'm fighting anti-Semitism. I'm Jewish in spite of all of that. I'm Jewish because it's how I was raised. It's because it's in my blood, and most importantly for me, because of the values.
You realize that you already gave us probably one of the tags for this episode. I'm not Jewish because of anti-Semitism. I'm Jewish in spite of it. Lishi, what kind of a Jew are you?
Oh, it's a good question. Most people would probably put me in the category of some form of modern Orthodox. I like to say that I define my Judaism partly by practice and partly by peoplehood. Practice for me and connection to God and tradition is, you know, what I do as a Jew, and what I believe has kind of kept the Jewish tradition and the Jewish people alive for literally millennia. And peoplehood is what I feel so connected to. Peoplehood and God, but peoplehood and the Jewish people and the Jewish story is what I feel so connected to. And to me, without connection to the Jewish story and to Jewish people and to the Jewish people with a capital P, practice is kind of less meaningful for me. And I also want to point out that my family and my friends at home, I basically have been in the most Jewish environment that you could be in. I had the best Jewish education that money can buy.
Where is home?
In Brookline, Massachusetts.
Huh?
I was in Jewish day school my entire life. I spent a gap year at the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem. And I feel like in terms of my Jewish literacy, it's obviously still growing, but thanks to my parents and my education, I feel very connected to understanding Judaism and living Judaism. So again, I'm also very proud. I think Jewish values, Jewish practice, and the Jewish people define who I am as a Jew.
I love that. And notice one thing I've noticed, you know, a lot of people talk about the Jewish people and they don't understand, a lot of people that are not Jewish don't understand that. And when you have like these, and we'll probably talk about these like anti-Zionist JVP Jews, they don't talk about the Jewish people. They say, I'm a Jewish person. And when people say, you're not Jewish, I'm like, no, they are Jewish. They are Jewish people, but they're not part of the Jewish people, right? They've excluded themselves from that construct of community that we have, that peoplehood.
Yeah. To me, the thing that's so upsetting is, I'm not one to question one's Judaism. If a Jew is a Jew is a Jew. You know, if your mother's Jewish, you're Jewish. But to me, something that I just can't understand is how a Jewish person could look at 50% of the Jewish people, which lives in Israel, and say this person, you know, these people, this half of the Jewish people deserves to die for the sake of some political existential agenda against Zionism in the state of Israel. That is like kind of removing yourself from the community in a way that's very upsetting.
Yeah, they've literally moved themselves from the kahila. But we'll get to that. The thing that's interesting about the two of you is, I think October 7 activated a lot of Jews around the world, but mostly or mainly Jewish students that felt like they were thrown into like the battleground. But the two of you were active Jewish organizers on campus before October 7. So tell me a little bit about that. Eden, you want to start?
Sure.
And tell people that don't know, what is SSI, Students Supporting Israel?
Yeah, so Students Supporting Israel at the time of October 7th or even before was pretty much the only active pro-Israel group on campus, period. Lishi and Eliana hadn't yet revived Arya, and he'll talk about that in a second. It's a really interesting story. But Students Supporting Israel is basically, you know, we're one chapter of a national grassroots pro-Israel movement, period. We're not Jewish. We're not religiously affiliated. We're also not political. So we simply advocate for Israel as the ancestral homeland of the Jewish people on campus. And we're registered as a Columbia Club, which sounds like a technicality, but actually was a source of a lot of struggle with Columbia and with the administration last year, with them not giving us permission to do events when we saw SJP and JVP doing basically whatever they wanted.
SJP being Students for Justice in Palestine, or Jihad, yes, in Palestine, and JVP being Jewish Voice for Peace.
Right.
Or the irony. More like Jewish Voice for Palestine. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, Students Supporting Israel was a club on campus, but wasn't really active before October 7th. And then a friend, you know, at the beginning of the semester, just got to Columbia from Tel Aviv University, is in the dual BA program, and said, I really want to revive this club. Let's do it. And he's now the president, Mikael Rachman. He's leading the club, which is very exciting.
Who's also Rudy Rachman's younger brother.
Yes.
Yeah. Who was at Columbia and was...
Founded SSI.
And founded SSI at Columbia.
Yes. Big, big family ties. but I share that to say that we sort of had no infrastructure. And so Mikael and I decided, like, end of September, okay, we're going to revive this club and really create a pro-Israel movement on campus.
Wait, so end of September 2023.
Crazy timing.
Okay.
Yes.
So like two weeks before October 7th.
Literally, I think 2 weeks before October 7th, I became the president of Students Supporting Israel. He became the vice president. And we said, it's time to bring back the pro-Israel movement at Columbia.
Did you sense that something was happening? Because here's the crazy thing, something that I still cannot explain. And I oppose conspiracy theories. I'm sure people listening will be like, that's a conspiracy. But on October 6th, Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, posted on their Instagram page a map of Israel. And it says, we're back. Mm-hmm. On October 6th. And it was like they had a dormant account. They were kind of dormant on campus. And they said, we're back October 6th. And October 7th happens. I don't want to read too much into it. Did they know? Did they not know? Were they told? Blah, blah, blah. But they were back. You started SSI like before. Like, was there a sense inside of you that something's coming? Or was it just...
It's so chilling to think about, because, by the way, there was also like a massively detailed toolkit that National Students for Justice in Palestine released on October 8th.
Yeah, with the hashtag Al-Aqsa Flood, which was the name that Hamas gave the attack on Israel.
So, you know, and I think as the year progressed, we saw more like peculiarities, to put it diplomatically, of that nature, like the same tents popping up all around the country. We saw the encampments pop up in waves geographically, you know, New York schools, Los Angeles schools, Midwestern schools, and we can get into more detail about that. But certainly like last year, or I guess in 2022, you know, Students for Justice in Palestine was not really active on Columbia's campus. In fact, for the 2 years prior where I was on campus, there was basically no presence.
So what made you want to, September 2023, what made you want to restart SSI? If there was nothing on campus, why did you need a pro-Israel voice?
It's like I said earlier, I'm not Jewish and proud because of anti-Semites. It's despite the anti-Semites that I'm Jewish and proud. And the same goes for my Zionism and the fact that I am pro-Israel. There's, you know, the fact that there was no anti-Israel movement on campus is sort of irrelevant to the fact that we needed to revive a pro-Israel movement. And again, like I hesitate to call the Free Palestine movement pro-Palestinian because they are explicitly not. They're pro-Hamas and they have said it time and time again. These are their words, not mine. But, you know, Columbia is...
Not more than that. I would say like they oppose Palestinian voices that call out Hamas. They never bring in speakers that are Palestinians that are critical of Hamas. Like they oppose policies that would help Palestinians, like a two-state solution.
Exactly.
They are hardline terrorism supporters, right? Hamas, it's not just Hamas, it's Palestinian Islamic Jihad, PFLP, it's Hezbollah. You know, they support Iran. Your parents fled Iran.
And that is what's so chilling. And I spoke about this when I testified in Congress, that it's the same narrative and the same rhetoric and violence that drove my family to the United States out of Iran that we're now seeing take root on American college campuses. And I spoke to my grandmother, who was living in Tehran at the time, and she said that the universities in Tehran in the 70s look the way that the Ivy Leagues and other American universities look today. And that, to me, is terrifying. Because the values that...
Quite the admonition, by the way.
Well, exactly. I mean, the values that these groups are supporting are not, like you said, about security or peace or coexistence or, as they even put it, collective liberation. It's about demonizing the Jewish state, demonizing the Jewish people, and, as they like to say, calling for the total eradication of Western civilization. And that is what led to the downfall of Iran and led to the creation of the Islamic Republic. And I'm not saying America's on track to become...
No, because we are fighting back.
Exactly.
All right. So we have SSI, which is a Columbia club that is... You don't have to be Jewish. And by the way, I went to their tabling the other day and then some new first-year student came up to me, you know, introduced themselves and said, can I join the club if I'm not Jewish? I was like, yeah, you can join a club if you think Israel has a right to exist.
Exactly.
So you have that. But then what is Arya? Which I think is not the opposite, but fills a different kind of role.
Yeah, it does. It fills a different role on campus. So Arya translates from Hebrew to lion, because we're the Columbia Lions.
I didn't get that.
That's the name.
The mascot is Rory.
Yeah, exactly. Rory the lion. So basically, Arya existed in the past as Lion Pack. It was an APAC club at the Hillel. Then it was Arya. And then during COVID, it kind of wasn't so active. It was kind of dormant. And so I came to Columbia as a freshman after the Hartman Institute. And I felt like I was coming in, you know, on the heels of literally the most sophisticated, interesting Israel engagement of my life. And I got to Columbia and I found that there like wasn't enough of that kind of educational engagement with Israel and Zionism that would have kind of been a continuation from what I was used to from high school and from the Hartman Institute.
What kind of education? Like, tell me, like...
Like engaging with Zionism, religious Zionism and secular Zionism, engaging with, you know, interesting Palestinian speakers, by the way, who can kind of challenge us and force us to think. Like, those were the kinds of things that really got me going. And it's not a coincidence that I'm studying Middle East history, because I came here wanting to challenge myself and wanting to grow my vocabulary and be able to engage with people across the aisle. Obviously, having essentially been canceled on campus, it's pretty much impossible. But I came, you know, so I came into the Hillel and I spoke to them and I was like, listen, let's revive this club and let's let's make it really good and make like, you know, this was before October 7th and make the kinds of opportunities that we provide like really high level. And they were all in. And so we started
having, why did you go to the Hillel and not Columbia?
Yeah, so I'll get to that.
Oh, okay.
So we started talking.
There's a story there.
There's a story there. So we started talking. And at the time, I hadn't realized the significance of going to Hillel versus just starting a club. I went to Hillel because they were a support system on campus. And we started talking and we started trying to kind of make it happen. Then October 7th happens. And we're thrown into the fire, basically. And Eden and I and a few others organized and led a rally on campus on October 12th, basically at the same time as the SJP rally. But we did 22 minutes of silence, which was a second for every victim at the time. And then we got in a huge circle and sang Jewish songs and did a few prayers. And it was a show of grief and community and unity and mourning. Like, this was not the time to be screaming back on October 12th. We were still literally bagging dead bodies. So that's what we did. And as the semester and the year went on, I found myself constantly defending Zionism and defending Zionism as part of my Judaism, because Israel is such a central part of my Jewish identity. And I have so many friends that are in the army. And by the way, the guilt that I feel for not being in the IDF is part of the reason that I was so inclined to just step into this immediately.
You're in a way, you are in the IDF.
Not even Lahavdil. I say Lahavdil.
Of course. But you are part of the defending forces of Israel.
I like to think that I'm playing
ideological
a small part.
Defensive.
Ideological defense, exactly. So I started defending, having to defend and defend. And it's all about Judaism and Zionism. And I realized how important it is to have the strong Jewish Zionist club advocating for Israel, educating about Israel in the Kraft Center for Jewish Student Life, which is the Hillel. Because Jewish student life and Israel engagement are the same. And they're part of the same coin. So I'm very happy to be running the Israel Club in the Hillel, because I think that it sends a message like our Zionism and our Israel advocacy and our Israel education is part of our lives as Jewish students. And, you know, and the Center for Jewish Student Life needs to have a strong Israel voice. And so that's what we're trying to be.
So, but here's the thing, both Eden and Lishi, like, I've seen you like in rallies and protests together. I've seen you give interviews together. Why two clubs? You clearly like, you like your each other, your friends, you work together. Why different? Like, do you have different audiences? Do you have different goals? Is it important that we have multiple clubs or just one club? And the reason I'm asking this is because I'm sure a lot of Jewish students across the United States are thinking, should I start my own club? Should I join a club? You know,
well, I think both clubs serve a very important role, and we do so much together, right? We're not competing for members. Mm-hmm. I would hope that people who are in the REA announcements chat are also in the SSI announcements chat and vice versa. You know what I mean? So that's something that, for starters, we're not competing. The importance of having a club that's just under Columbia and that doesn't necessarily have to identify as part of the Jewish student life is there's potential to reach people that wouldn't necessarily be in Hillel.
So that's the SSI.
That's SSI.
Right. So like if I'm like a Hindu student, Christian student, a Muslim student, you know, would, or maybe even like a Jewish student that doesn't really think about Hillel as like a place for them, which they should, but you know, then they won't come to Aria, they would, but SSI is still there for them.
That's possible. And at the same time, I think there are people that wouldn't necessarily find their voice in the Israel advocacy space without it coming from a Hillel space. Mm-hmm. So if we can kind of have two of these clubs thriving, big, which they are, and work together, that would actually potentially unite the audiences in a way that we wouldn't be able to do if we only had one club in the Hillel or we didn't have a club in the Hillel.
Do you have a sense of like how many people are on the mailing list or active members or?
Yeah, it's pretty big actually, like 500-ish for SSI. Yeah, and like Lishi said, there's so much overlap, which I think is really important. Because I also think it's important to have diversity within the pro-Israel movement on campus. of course, ideological diversity, but also, you know, like our goals are not exactly the same. REA does a lot of education, which is absolutely critical. And SSI focuses a little bit more so on advocacy, which obviously we know is critical for different reasons. But to have both working in tandem, I actually think is important because you can't advocate if you're not educated. So you kind of need both.
So the way I've been thinking about it, because people have been asking me like, what are the pillars of everything you do? And I say like, it's education, motivation, identity, and action, right? So education is what, like, you can't fight if you don't know what you're fighting against and what you're fighting for. Motivation is like the culture. Like, yeah, like it's not just learning the facts, but it's like the Ishai Rebo, like, you know, it's like, feeling part of this like culture, right?
It's peoplehood, by the way.
It's peoplehood. Identity is like your more personal safe. Like for me, it's like the wearing of the Star of David. For it could be a religious identity, but what's your in? And then SSI, which brings in the action, which is like, it's not enough just to be educated and motivated and have the identity. Like at some point you have to go out there and hold a flag and say, enough's enough, right? So it's all those four together.
And that's something, by the way, that we're working on also building. My co-chair, David Lederer, and his twin, Johnny, are like the number one activists on behalf of Israel and the Jewish people at Columbia. Like they are the bravest and most courageous people that I know. And they're out there with flags, American and Israeli flags. They're out there with hostage posters. David has organized last year, every Tuesday, we sat out there with the hostage signs and we gave out the necklaces. And we were just there and anyone could come talk to us. And it means a lot to me that he's also my co-chair in REA because—
With Eliana.
With Eliana, yes, of course. With Eliana Golden, who's amazing. And by the way, smarter than all of us and so good at putting together, you know—
She really puts the, you know, the Maim Shketim Chodrim Amok, like the, I don't know how you'd say it in English, like with like water runs deep, like silent water runs deep, I guess. Like she's like— She's understated, but she, you know, she gets...
She's so good and she's such a good writer and such a good mm-hmm. teacher. And the three of us kind of bringing our different lenses to this. This is what's going to try and build REA up to be kind of a sustainable educational force, but also that brings that knowledge that we're trying to bring to people into action and into advocacy. And like we look to partner with SSI on that. Because they're so good at it.
Love that. You know, it's funny. So David Lederer and his twin brother, Johnny Lederer, like I have been blamed like on videos where they are like counter-protesting. People are saying that's Shai and his twin. And and my response is always, A, I don't have a twin. And B, not all Jews look alike, you know. But and we don't even look alike, you know. But it's
they
like,
look alike.
Well, they obviously, they're twins. Obviously, they look alike. But I don't look like them other than the fact that I am an Ashkenazi Jew, which for some people is enough to say we look alike. So let's get into what has been your experiences on campus in the 2023-2024 academic year. And both as like organizers and leaders, but also just like as Lishi and Eden, like, you know, what's it been like? I know what's been like as a professor and I know the stories I hear, but I'm not you.
Yeah, I mean, it's been obviously hard. On one hand, at least in the beginning, there was something actually empowering about the ability to like have a reason to really speak out. And like you said in the beginning, it really unlocked people's Zionism and Judaism in a way that maybe wouldn't have happened. And it displayed for people that like the Jewish people are here and we are here and we're fighting back, like you said. And in that sense, there was something empowering about being able to use my voice. But on the other hand, as someone who wants to engage with the Middle East, the second I started using my voice and the second we started using our voices, we effectively become persona non grata, blacklisted at Columbia. So by the SJP, at least by the leadership, I've had a number of experiences where I'll go with an Israeli or American flag to kind of stand there and counter protest. And I'll go up to people, listen, like, do you want to have a conversation? Like, do you understand what you're calling for when you say, there is only one solution, Intifada revolution? Or do you understand what you're calling for when you say, we don't want two states, we want all of it? Let's have a conversation about it. And once in a while, someone's willing to engage. And it always takes probably maximum 2 minutes for a leader of SJP to walk over fully masked and say, to the other person, you're not allowed to engage with him. You're not allowed to engage. And I say, listen, we're trying to have a conversation.
Let's unpack that for a second, because I've seen these things happen, but I don't think the audience, people listening in or watching, have seen this. Like, when the leader of a protest, you know, an anti-Israel protest, comes to a protester who's engaging with the other side and just speaking, like, they don't have any power over them.
No, but they have social power over them. And the idea, and part of the problem with these protests, is that they've turned it into like the, you know, if you're going to be politically active, you're either going to join the pro-Israel side and be canceled, or you're going to join the Free Palestine movement and gain social credibility for wearing a keffiyeh, even if you don't know what you're talking about. So these people see them as like these social justice heroes, even though they're calling for violence against Jews, and they don't know any of the history. So I try to engage to try and show them the human side of a Jew and of a Zionist. But the leaders of the SJP and JVP basically refuse to allow protesters to engage. I think partly because they're afraid of what happens if their sheep basically see the humanity of a Jew and realize, wait a second, there's something not right going on in this Free Palestine movement.
Interesting. So it's the humanity, but also maybe they're worried that they are giving them a very specific indoctrination. And if they are, even if you just tell them, Google the Hebron massacre of 1929 or 1922, and they would be, but I thought history starts in 48.
Right.
And then you just tell them, don't trust me, just Google it. You know, it starts poking holes in this perfect brainwashing machine.
Right. Google the 1947 partition plan. How about that? How about the fact that a Palestinian state was on the table? And, you know, the SJP would like to basically completely block their followers from being able to learn that history. Because if they learned it, I think there would be a lot more nuance and a lot less anti-Semitic protesting and a lot more conversation and real engagement, which would go against, of course, the policy of no normalization, which effectively for SJP means don't talk to Zionists because it normalizes Zionism.
Right. It's for people not who don't know what that is. Anti-normalization is actually one of the core tenets of this anti-Israel
BDS movement.
Right. Yeah. It's not just don't speak with Jews that refuse to denounce their Zionism, their identity. It's also don't have Israeli or Jewish speakers, no courses, anything that would make us seem normal, that's the anti-normalization, is off the table. Eden, what about you? Because I've heard you talk about losing friends.
Yeah, I look, like we joke about being Columbia canceled, but at the beginning it was really hurtful because it was so surprising. Like people that I considered very close friends that knew what I believed in before October 7th simply cut me off without a conversation.
Like, what does that mean, cut you off?
Unfollowed on social media, stopped speaking to me altogether. Like I would walk by people who would avert their gaze, people that I, you know, would have lunch with on a weekly basis the year before. And I've never been shy about my Zionism and certainly not my Judaism. But something shifted on October 7th. And I think it goes back to this anti-normalization culture that SJP has created. And by the way, it isn't just like the leadership of these clubs, that have like canceled us, like Lishi was talking about. They've created a culture in which like you will get canceled if you're seen engaging with a Zionist.
So a non-Jew who stays friends with a vocal Jew who refuses to denounce their identity, basically, is canceled.
I mean, it's not as black and white as that, certainly, but at least within the sort of broad tent of the, like, what they would call the pro-Palestinian movement, and again, what I don't call the pro-Palestinian movement on campus, that's certainly the case. And I do really want to, like, acknowledge that isn't everyone. Like I have several incredibly close friends that are not Jewish that have been just unbelievably supportive over the last year. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that, because even though it feels like the Jewish community is alone, we're not entirely alone and we do still have allies. And by the way, it's never too
brave
late
allies.
To be an ally. Yeah. Yes, but even that in itself to me is so ridiculous that to be an ally to the Jewish people automatically, you know, means that you're being brave because you do have something to lose. How is that the reality in America in 2024, especially on a campus that prizes itself on inclusion and on acceptance like Columbia? The hypocrisy is just astounding. And by the way, I mean, when it comes to the topic of this, like, sort of hypocritical, fight for free speech that has somehow become embedded in the Free Palestine movement. And I know you have a lot to say on this as well. But I just find it, ridiculous that the same people silencing every single view that could offer any sort of dissent or alternative perspective or alternative cause to advocate for are shut out. Like, we've all been blocked by these groups on social media. We've been blocked by their leaders. We have been, you know, shouted down. We have been like whatever you could possibly imagine. And you, I think, have probably experienced the worst, the worst of it.
But I always tell people, maybe, but I'm 41. So I can take it. And I don't live near, you know, I don't live on campus. I have my wife and my children. And if the entire world cancels me, I will still have my wife and my children and my parents and my siblings, and I will be fine. It's different when you're 20 than when you're 40. And I acknowledge that. It's not, you know. And by the way, when it was found out that this white non-Jewish 40-year-old man was in the encampments and then helped take over Hamilton Hall, the son of multimillionaires, which is like the definition of privilege. That's the guy that also attacked the blue-collar custodian that was in Hamilton Hall. I was like, I can understand how a 20-year-old gets swooped up in this movement and becomes a sheep. I will not... You know, I will never understand and will never, you know, accept the fact that a 40-year-old dude, you know, I don't even know what he is, you know, does that. What about in classes? How has been your experience in the class? Because, Lishi, I know that you actually took a class with one of the main leaders, the organizers of these protests, and who also, we don't have to mention his name if you don't want to, up to you, but there was also, like, I don't know if it was a close friend, but you were on friendly terms.
Yeah, it was interesting. Definitely, I feel really lucky to have been able to reach out to Palestinian students like this one, and we took a class together called Peacemaking and Negotiation. And the truth is, I give him credit for doing that with me.
For taking the class.
For taking the class, and we got coffee pretty regularly. And I learned a lot from him, and I hope that he learned from me. And part of that was about just humanizing each other. And that's what college is supposed to be. The sad part is that it basically had to be off the record and under the table. Because if we were seen together, like, in too friendly of a way, that would reflect negatively on him. Because, again, the Free Palestine movement is so against anything that comes off as normalizing the other.
I must break this down because you have a leader, one of the leaders in the movement who, like, goes and you know, leads people in chants for globalizing the Intifada. You know, I know this person specifically have also, like, you know, bragged about throwing rocks at IDF soldiers when he was a teenager, blah, 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 all that stuff during the second Intifada.
I didn't know about that, by the way.
Yeah.
I did not, at the time, I did not know about that.
And it's like, so he knows what an intifada is. And at the same time, he takes a class on peacemaking and negotiations, showing some open-mindedness, but that has to be in secret. So the sheep won't know that the wolf.
Yeah, the dynamic there is, like, really backwards and twisted. And it's so sad, by the way. It's such a sad reality of their movement that that's how it has to be. But again, for me at least, you know, I'm 21 years old. I'm a junior at Columbia. I'm not going to solve the Middle East situation right now. But But, you know, I know that
I love that right now because people listening in, it was like Lishi Baker 20 years from now. So we'll get a clip to be like, you know, going viral.
But I hope that, I mean, this is what I'm interested in and passionate about because I care. And because I've, again, because of my friends that are in the IDF and my friends that are in Israel, I feel like anything that I can do to make them proud is what I want to be doing. And I know that these are conversations that I'm going to be a part of for the rest of my life about not just about anti-Semitism and standing up for the Jewish people, but also about like Israel and what do we want the future of Israel to look like and how do we make, you know, lives better for Israelis and Palestinians alike. Those are conversations that I'm going to be in. And this is the time to begin and to practice and to understand the other so that when the conversations maybe are higher stakes, hopefully, if I can get to a position where it would be higher stakes, I have a little more understanding. And that's something I will always appreciate about my relationship with this Palestinian student. So again, it was interesting. I wish that it could have been public. There is an article about it actually. And it's about—
Who wrote?
No, not with us. It was a British documentarian who interviewed us and actually caught it. There's a clip that didn't go viral, but there's a clip actually of me walking. So I was walking to Hillel for Kabbalat Shabbat for Friday night services. And in my hand, I literally had like a tin of broccoli because I cooked for Shabbat dinner, broccoli. And I'm wearing, you know, I'm tucked in, kippah on. I had no phone on me because I put it away for Shabbat. I turned the corner on 116th and Broadway and there he is being interviewed by the documentary. And we had like a moment where I'm standing here with my broccoli on my way to Friday night services. And we're like, basically, we don't agree, but let's continue the conversation. And that was a beautiful moment.
It is beautiful, but I do have to push a little bit on that because I've had my own personal experiences with this specific leader. We were featured together on 60 Minutes. Then we had a one-on-one behind the scenes conversation, the two of us. And then I see him in protest. And I see a very different person. And this is just one case study, obviously. A very different person in front of the cameras versus in front of the movement. And I have to ask myself, who is the real person here?
I mean, it's a fair question. I completely agree with you. And part of what I think is valuable is that having kind of a cordial relationship allows me to basically text and say, what the heck? You know, there was a night on Columbia's campus, I think it was April 20th. It was a Saturday night when, you know, there was an Israeli flag burned, multiple students assaulted inside the gates. Go back to Poland, go back to Belarus. You have no culture. That's what they were chanting at the Jewish students. And I texted him, get this under control right now. And he basically was like, you know, I'll check on it. But I think, and the Jewish students were kind of gone by that point. But I think there's value to being able to have conversations, have personal relationships. And obviously, I'm not looking past the things that these people say. But being able to say, listen, this is how I feel when you personally call for intifada is like, I think it's powerful. And I think it adds a human element to the conversation that just wouldn't be there if we just said, basically, I won't speak to you.
Yeah. Because that's, yeah, exactly. Because then we would be stooping to the level that exactly. We're criticizing.
Exactly.
How about your classes, Eden?
So I'm majoring in Middle East studies. And to be completely honest, I cross-check every single class that I take the professor with this letter that came out in October that was signed by, I think it was like maybe around 100.
120 professors, yeah.
Basically contextualizing October 7th.
They called it a military response, basically.
Exactly. And I came to Columbia choosing to major in Middle East studies, knowing that I would probably disagree with a lot of the faculty and a lot of what I would be learning. But like Lishi said, that's the point of college. Like, I want to be pushed. I want to learn perspectives and stories that I otherwise wouldn't, that I can't relate to. That's the point of an education, and especially a Columbia education. That's what the university sort of prizes itself on, is its like global perspective. I didn't think that would mean as much sheer support for terrorism as it does. And it like sort of breaks my heart to say that. And maybe that's naive at this point, 11 months later. But I am very cautious about the courses I take. And in fact, I wanted to take a class on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to complete my major last year. And I couldn't, because the only one that the university offered was being taught by Joseph Massad, who wrote on, I think it was October 9th.
October 8th.
October, I mean, to my point.
It was published on October 8th, so he wrote it on October 7th.
Yeah. And what he wrote was that the scenes of, you know, corpses and burnt bodies and raped and mutilated women were awesome and made him feel jubilant. And there has to be...
Unless people like are like, oh, you know, there's no ambiguity, because at the top of the article, and it's still on electronicintifada.com, is a picture of the Al-Qassam Brigade, like the Hamas military wing that's basically engaged in the massacre.
And to me...
And this is a Columbia professor.
A tenured Columbia professor who is the only one teaching a course on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it's troublesome, one, because I can't, you know, complete coursework on a topic that I am passionate about and interested in learning more about. But two, what does that mean for all of the other students that have never taken a course on Israel or on the conflict and don't know anything about Zionism, for example? And this is the only offering. And so they're learning from someone who basically thinks, you know, that Hamas is justified.
Openly hates Israel and Jews.
Correct. To me, that is terrifying. And unfortunately, I think that it's not so much a bug of the Middle East Studies Department at Columbia, but, you know, rather like a quality, which is part of the reason why I'm suing the university now.
Are there any Israeli professors in the Middle East Institute?
There, I think, is one.
Let me rephrase that question. Are there any professors in the Middle East Institute or studies that believe that Israel has a right to exist?
It's a good question. The actual Institute for Israel and Jewish Studies is completely separate from the Middle East Studies Department. So the majority of courses on Israel are actually not listed as Middle East Studies classes.
Because Israel is not in the Middle East, apparently.
Exactly. I mean, I think that answers your question. Like, how, one, like, that is ridiculous. And two, as a student majoring in this department who wants to take classes on Israel, I have to actually appeal those courses to count for my major. They don't count because Israel is not part of the Middle East in the eyes of, I guess, whoever
Columbia
is.
Columbia University.
By the way, the irony is that they say both that Israel is not part of Judaism, that's what they try to tell us, and that it's not part of the Middle East. Yeah. So they're trying to basically remove Israel from the two things that it is, which is the Jewish state and part of a Jewish identity, and a Middle Eastern state and in the Middle East.
I mean, and I agree with you, it's not a bug, it's a feature. It's a concerted effort to erase our existence, right? To erase, like, they tell you, it's okay that you're Jewish. The problem is that you're a Jew that prays twice a day or three times a day to Israel facing Jerusalem. The problem is that on Passover, you say next year in Jerusalem, that's everything about you is okay, just everything that you do. And at the same time, like, erasing us from the Middle East, erasing us from where not we are now, but also we have been for 2,000 years. And that erasure, you know, it's not you and I, we don't fall for it.
No, of course not.
But 18-year-old Columbia students lap it up.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. It's actually very upsetting. And that's like a double-edged sword, the double erasure, that we have to fight back at the same time. So, like, I think that Israel studies should be listed in the Middle East Studies Department and listed in the Jewish Studies Department, because that's what it is, period. And Israel engagement should be part of Middle East engagement and part of Jewish student engagement. It's both.
Yeah, it's such an obvious thing. So I'm going to ask you, Eden, if you had 15 minutes with Joseph Massad one-on-one, what would you say? And it doesn't have to be PG, but what would you?
I mean, at the end of the day, I think that someone, and, you know, a lot of the work that Lishi and I do and the entire pro-Israel community at Columbia focuses on is on engagement and having those difficult conversations. But I think it comes to a point where sometimes you have to accept that someone is too far gone and that someone's beliefs will not change because they fundamentally reject your right to exist. And I'm not asking for much to come to the conversation table. You know, I want to have conversations with people that I fiercely disagree with. But there has to be a baseline acknowledgement that I exist and I have a right to exist and you exist and you have a right to exist. And with someone that fundamentally rejects that notion, I can't see how any common ground can be found and how any progress can be made. And I think, unfortunately, that he is one of the people that fall beyond the pale.
But you're so even keel, and I want to know if that's, you're just keeping composure or not. Like, because we're not just talking about someone. Like, we're talking about a tenured Columbia professor. How does it feel for you that a tenured Columbia professor, in your words, does not believe you have the right to exist?
I think I'm past the point of hurt. I'm past the point of surprise. And by the way, when I say hurt, I don't necessarily mean by him, for example. I mean by the university, because Columbia University makes a concerted effort, they claim, to ensure that every member of their community feels welcome and accepted. But the line is drawn at the Jewish community. We are not welcome in far too many spaces at the university, physically, in spaces like, for example, the lawn where the encampment happened, where we were...
The quote-unquote liberated zone.
Liberated from Jews.
Yeah, it's liberated from Israelis and Jews who refuse to denounce their identity. That's what it's liberated from. Like, I've never seen a liberated zone where there are guards telling people who can and can't come in.
That's faculty the opposite guards, of by the way.
Faculty guards.
And this is my point of like...
Let's stall okay, on that sorry. For a second. Faculty, professors at Columbia who are paid by Columbia, whose salaries are paid partially by donors, and I would say also by Jewish donors... They were standing there basically saying, Israelis and Jews who refuse to denounce their identity, not welcome here. That is something that, like, every time I think about, you know, Professor Gil Troy from McGill, that I know you've worked with, calls this not just anti-Semitism, anti-Israel, it's educational malpractice. Mm-hmm.
It is. It's educational malpractice, both in terms of their activism, but also in terms of the way that they bring their activism into the classroom and into their jobs. I think it's important to note that two of those professors who were defending the encampment are on the rules committee.
Yeah, Susan Bernofsky and Jonathan Slaughter.
Yes.
And who, by the way, blocked me on Twitter because that's how they believe in freedom of exchange of ideas and free speech.
And they make student demonstration policy, and they're also in charge of helping write the disciplinary procedure for people who break rules. And they actively engage in breaking rules. It is so twisted.
Yeah, it's in the world they created. It's not twisted because they keep getting paid by Columbia. They keep getting published. They keep getting their, you know, book deals. Full disclosure, Susan Bernofsky used to be like my wife's teacher when she was a Columbia master's student. She hired my wife to teach translation at Columbia. We always knew that she, you know, she had a problem with Israeli policies, which, by the way, I do too sometimes. We did not know that she hates our existence. So, okay, so we got the students, we got the faculty, and then we get to the administration. Tell me about the administration. Like, if, you know, you've had some experiences with the administration and disciplinary, what happened there?
Yeah. So first of all, I want to just note that I think it's important to just say that the structure of governance at Columbia is... So I wouldn't blame only the executive administration, because the structure of governance at Columbia empowers the faculty so much, such as the Rules Committee, that in some ways the administration is like structurally paralyzed. I do think that there's a way to overcome that. And I hope that, you know, we have a new president. I hope that she will do that. But the interest of my experience with kind of the disciplinary thing, so thank God I'm still in good academic standing, but there was the way that student demonstrations work is, at least last year, you have to basically register your event and get approval 48 hours in advance. So whenever we did a rally or we did a table on campus or anything,
By the way, that used to be 5 days in advance.
Used to be 10.
10 days. But then because SJP and JVP, they made such a big noise and fuss. They actually made it easier for them by saying, okay, you don't want to do it 10 days? We'll give you 48 hours. Is that okay? Can you do four? And they still wouldn't.
And they still wouldn't do it. So there was one day that you were there and I was there with David Lederer.
It was my first time showing up to a counter protest. Yeah.
Well, there's a good video that they tried. They posted a video of me, you, and David and talked about how that we're like the worst trio at Columbia. But
I thought we were quite a good trio. I would say the worst trio. I would say the worst trio is Joseph Massad, Rashid Khalidi, and Catherine Frank, but you know, to each their own.
To each their own. So that day, you know, they had a protest. We technically don't know what's registered and what's approved and what's not. So we showed up with our megaphones. You know, they chant Free Palestine. We say from Hamas, we sang Hatikva, we sang the American, you know, the national anthem. And I get an email later in the day, and I think David did as well. From Columbia, you have to click a secure link, a disciplinary warning, basically, you know, for violating the protest guidelines because you used amplified sound, meaning the megaphone, at an unauthorized protest. I'm like, wait a second, hold on. I understand, wait a second, this protest was unauthorized. It was their protest that they didn't register. And now I showed up to counter, but I'm not wearing a mask. So I'm the one, and David, who's not wearing a mask, is the one who gets the email about disciplinary warning. So that felt so wrong. Right?
So basically, like it's like the police saying, we don't arrest the criminals, we arrest whoever we can catch.
Right. I mean, the other side is all wearing masks. So I assume the people who are wearing masks are unidentifiable and don't get disciplinary warnings because the cameras don't catch them. Right? So at that point, I'm like, first of all, clearly we need to say no masks during protests, because if you're going to enforce rules, it has to be enforced fairly, and you have to be able to enforce them. So the first thing that I think this is an easy fix. The first thing that I think Columbia University needs to do is just say, if you're going to demonstrate, you cannot wear a mask. If you wear a mask while you demonstrate, we will find you, ID you, and you'll be held accountable for breaking a policy.
But Columbia would never do that, because this is exactly what we mean when we say the bureaucracy is like systemically flawed. And by the way, we talk about pervasive anti-Semitism. Like, this is exactly what we mean. Lishi got an infraction for being at an unregistered event that, you know, the Free Palestine movement hosted and was literally like chanting him down. He got in trouble. Meanwhile, you know, it's September 13th today. I filed like four reports back in July about like aggravated harassment from student leaders of this movement targeting me and harassing me and my family, by the way, on social media. And I still haven't heard back from the university. They've done nothing about it.
And I should say about that protest, it was the first time that I showed up, because I've been staying away. I was worried. I was afraid. I was afraid for my life. I was afraid for my career. And this was after like the president's shameful testimony in front of Congress, which the world already knows that she's lied multiple times. And I knew it was unauthorized. The university acknowledged it's unauthorized. They said that this will not go on. They did go on. So I show up, and you and David and some other people were there. And then he's no longer at Columbia. He retired. But the senior vice president, Jerry Rosberg, was there observing the protests. So I go up to him and I say, like, hey, Jerry, what's going on? Like, this is unauthorized. Are you going to do something? And he says, we'll see. I said, what are you waiting to see? Like, are you waiting for someone to get beat up? Like, what's... But that's what they were waiting for. They were waiting for it to escalate so they will be forced to do so. They want Jews, they don't want, but they are willing to have Jewish students attacked so that they can do something. How twisted is that?
I think what's the most disturbing part is that we saw Jewish students get attacked in April multiple times, like Lishi said, and the university still hasn't done anything. It's astounding to me. They talk about like, they're amending the rules, or they did amend the rules for demonstration policy. But the amendment actually loosened the rules so that Jewish students are now less protected by the university. It weakens the disciplinary action that the university can and will take. But those rules only applied to unregistered student clubs. And I know that it's like, not to get so into the weeds, but it's actually important here because SJP, JVP, and their coalition, the Columbia University Apartheid Divest Coalition, can basically do whatever they want. Like, we walked to class in the School of International and Public Affairs, and there was a protest in the middle of the building against Hillary Clinton, who's teaching a course at Columbia. And the university Senate delegates were there watching and didn't do anything about it. The protest went on. And last week, I got an email to the Student Supporting Israel email saying we need to register any events with potential for disruption, protests, rallies, speakers, 3 weeks in advance. And last time I tried to do an event without approval from the university, they threatened to take action against the club and against me personally. But meanwhile, students who are advocating against Israel can essentially do whatever they want on campus, completely free from repercussions. It is like textbook discrimination.
So I'm going to ask you a one-word question. Why? Why is this happening? Why is the university letting this? I'm not like, you know, the leaders, Joseph Mossad's heart, they're blackened, you know, they're blackened and they're closed to Kfir Bibas. They're closed to the sexual, like in a way that my heart is not closed to the civilian casualties in Gaza and I feel the pain. They don't care. Okay. Why does the administration allow this to happen in courses, in protests, you know, in all these different things you've been outlining?
I don't know if one word can capture it, but I'll do.
No, my question is a one word. You do whatever.
Shared governance and faculty empowerment is one reason, because that has created basically a culture of disempowered leadership. Because again, like basically the decision is, so the faculty is empowered, like I said, structurally to make the rules and deal with the disciplinary process. That's in the rules of university conduct. So that's a huge problem.
And I don't buy that, because then, I'm sorry if I'm cutting you off, but if the executive leadership of the university really does want to support Jewish students, then they should come and say, we think everything that's happening is abhorrent and the faculty senate will not let us do it.
I agree with you. But they won't even say that. The backside of that is, because they've been so empowered, the faculty are able to basically say, if you lead, we will go on strike. If you lead, we will vote no confidence. And so obviously I think that the 15% of the faculty or 20% of the faculty that actually would walk out of their classes, I think the university should just let that happen. I think they should say, these people, these faculty members are clearly not aligned with the values of the university. And probably if we kind of take action over the Senate and upset this group of faculty, in the long run, this might lead to actually hiring better faculty. So, but again, I do think it's important to note. So faculty empowerment and shared governance, extreme versions of it, is one thing. And then two is the, you know, academically, in terms of the classroom, the way that Middle East studies and some progressive ideologies have totally been entrenched in the humanities and in history, to paint Jews as oppressors, to paint Jews as white. To paint Jews, there have been protesters and activists that say the Jews are oppressors of all brown and black people. And that fits into this like Marxist progressive ideology. And the weird thing about today's anti-Semitism is that it's radical Islamist extremism merged with radical progressivism that paints Jews as oppressors. And those are friends that never would have been friends except for their shared enemy, that is the Jews.
The Green-Red Alliance.
It is like a weird, weird thing. And that has been so pervasive in the classroom. And I think that defines academically what the anti-Semitism we're facing is. And it's going to take years to undo this. It starts with changing the governance structure to empower leadership and leaders taking their power and using it. It also means changing hiring practices so that these professors that subscribe to these ideologies can't just hire each other and approve each other's tenure, because that's the replication of this ideology. And again, it also takes Jewish people standing up, explaining why it's problematic, and saying, we're going to love ourselves and we're going to be proud of who we are and show the world that it is okay to be proud of who you are. And we're going to reject the box of oppressor and oppressed, because it doesn't work for us.
That's the second tagline for this episode, by the way. Show the world that it's okay to be proud of who you are.
Yeah, that's the lesson we can teach as Jews.
It's such a clear thing that we should be all doing. Before we finish, I do want, you know, I want to hear about the REA library initiative that you're bringing in. And I want to hear, I don't know when this episode will be coming out, before or after October 7, but I want Eden for you to tell me about the art exhibit that's coming. So Lishi, start with the library initiative.
Yeah, so part of the educational mission of REA is both to do guest speakers, but also we understand it's a busy semester. Not everyone can make it. So what we've done is we've carved out a section in the Hillel building in like the library area for an REA library. And we're filling it and we're buying books, basically all Israel and Middle East related. And we're filling that section so that anyone who comes into the Hillel can educate themselves. And that goes back to what you're talking about with education and connection, right? We need to educate, but we also need people, you know, to feel who feel connected, to feel more connected and to feel empowered to do something. And that comes with reading narratives that can give them shared vocabulary. And we plan to take that library onto campus, maybe once a month, once every 2 weeks, with our little QR code and say, anyone who's interested about the Middle East, take 1 second out of your day, scan this QR code and take a book for free. And we'll give you the book and hopefully you'll return it, but we understand we'll probably have to just buy them again. And the idea is like, we hope they'll come to our events, but even for someone maybe who is afraid of the social ramifications of coming to our events, which of course is ridiculous, maybe we could reach them by giving them a book and letting them read it in the comfort of their room where no one can see. So that's the idea behind educating and empowering people slowly but surely to speak up and understand who we are and what we're fighting for.
I love that, spreading Jewish light. How about you, Eden? Tell me about the art exhibit.
So we're working on creating this sort of walkthrough installation on campus for October 7th. It's sort of replicated after the idea of the Nova exhibit, actually. And I had the privilege of going over the summer, Los Angeles. It opened in Los Angeles, and so I got to go when I was home. And I don't think, you know, I've seen, of course, too much of the footage, but I don't think anything really prepared me to physically walk through that space.
I broke down multiple times when I saw it in New York. I started crying before I walked in. Like, there was just like the happiness of before they show you a video of them dance, and I felt weird because I was also, everyone was looking at me while I was crying just hysterically, you know. But it's just, yeah.
And, you know, I actually haven't been back to Israel since October 7th. I know Lishi's actually been to Reim and been to the site. But again, like, I think being surrounded by this space that is supposed to sort of replicate what actually happened at the festival is chilling and critical for understanding, like, these were kids that went to a music festival.
Part of their education, it's experiencing. So you're Absolutely. Bringing that, you're bringing a version of that to campus.
So, and we're trying to focus, of course, on all of the aspects of, you know, the story that really unfolded on October 7th. So we're working with IAC to have them bring the giant hostage milk cartons.
Israeli
that they
American
had.
Council.
Yes. You know, the sort of like the installation they had outside the Democratic National Convention. They're helping us get some other artwork. We're going to be creating a lot of our own, but the point is really to tell this story that has been forgotten by the majority of the world already, outside of course, the Jewish world. And I really hope that October 7th will be a day for mourning and for grieving and for reflecting, because October 7th of 2023 in New York City was not a day of mourning. In fact, I actually feel like on campus, at least, we never really had time to actually grieve and mourn what happened on that day, because on October 8th, there were students making signs on October 8th, there were Columbia students making signs that said resistance is justified under occupation. That was the response. So I'm hoping that this year we'll be able to, you know, educate and also give our community space to be together and to grieve. But at the same time, we've heard that October 7th could potentially be explosive was the word that was used.
I hope not, but we'll see. All right. So I finish every episode with a series of what I've been calling Jewish lightning rounds, series of questions. There's no right or wrong answer. Just tell me the first thing that comes to mind. And you get one pass each, and I'll tell you if you get that pass. Okay, Lishi, what is the one thing people don't know about you?
I play golf.
Eden?
I was a cheerleader in high school.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
One thing people don't know about the Jews? We come from, I mean, we all come, obviously, date back to the land of Israel, but we're very ethnically diverse.
You stole my answer. That's exactly what I was going to say, that the Jewish community is actually far more diverse than I think anyone realizes.
What is your favorite curse?
Like curse
Hebrew, word? English. Yeah, a word, not a cursing.
Oh, God. A pass.
Benzona.
All right. I'm not going to explain what that is. When was the last time you cried?
Oh, man. Hirsch Goldberg Poland's funeral.
On the phone to Lishi yesterday, 2 days ago, I was feeling very overwhelmed. I feel like we're sort of students on the side these days, and sometimes it can be a lot.
Yeah. If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Menachem Begin.
Gold in my ear.
Wow. Prime ministers. I love it. What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Pesach.
Sukkot.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
I don't know if it's a holiday, but Tisha B'Av.
It's a yom.
I would also say Tisha B'Av.
When do you feel safest?
With my friends and family.
When I'm surrounded by fellow Jews.
Hmm. When do you feel least safe?
Downtown New York City, where waving an American flag.
Around campus during days of Within Our Lifetime protests.
We should say Within Our Lifetime is a rebranding of Students for Justice in Palestine. And it's basically, they've been terrorizing New York City for 11 months. What gives you hope?
What gives me hope? Honestly, our Columbia Jewish community and the way that people have been stepping up gives me hope.
Seeing the strength of Jewish student leaders across the country over the past year gives me so much hope.
By the way, also my friends in Israel give me a lot of hope. They're the strongest people I know.
Yeah. Ditto.
I think those three are mine. You know, the Jewish community at Columbia, the student leaders around the country, and my friends in Israel. What's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the words Jewish civil rights?
Jewish civil rights? I think about what we deserve. Jews are normal. Humanizing Jews.
Absolutely necessary and something that's no different from civil rights, period.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
The Hostage Family Forum.
The Women's International Zionist Organization, WIZO.
All right. Those are great. And by the way, for anyone listening, I get to speak to two people. So this week you have to donate twice, you know, pa'amayim ki tov. Listen, I really, really hope that not just, you know, every student, Jewish or non-Jewish student around the country that cares would listen to this and A, get like your spirit of like education and intelligence and activism, but B, also get like the specific concrete ideas of how to organize and fight back in a way that I think you've done beautifully, with no violence, with no peace, but also without any submissiveness. Where can people find you, Lishi?
Instagram and Twitter are my two main, and LinkedIn, but
what's your
Instagram is Lishi B, LISHIB, and Twitter is Lishi Baker.
Eden?
I'm also on Instagram and Twitter, or X, I should say.
X, sorry.
Just my name, at Eden Yadigar, on both.
Can you spell that for people?
Edenyadegar.
All right. Thank you so much for taking the time to come here to Hackensack, New Jersey to speak with me. And here I am with Lishi Baker and Eden Yadigar.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Professor.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."